just because we play what the people want.
It's pleasure. All right.
So them a call us pirates. Them a call us illegal broadcasters. PTI try stop us.
It's fragile. Very fragile.
John with Drew and Leslie, get the shit on. Interracial John, shut the fuck up and listen. Interracial John, interracial John, interracial shit motherfucker, shut up and listen. Drew and Leslie, interracial John.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Interracial Dawn Podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack, and I'm joined, as always,
by this very white guy.
And you are very white indeed. What's going on, dude?
Is this five in a row?
Something like that.
Wait.
We're in the pipe.
Five.
Wow.
Yes. You can find
You're welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, you're welcome, world. Just kidding. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John. That's JAWN, or go to interracialjohn.com. You can also send us feedback. You can leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. You can email us, interracialjohn@gmail.com. You can leave us a voicemail, 657-JOHNER, 657-JAWNERS. Thank you so much. If you do decide to leave some feedback for us, we appreciate it.
You sound like one of those, like on a car commercial, like at the end, like the, oh, this is they spit all the terms
like,
and
let me get all this gobbledygook out so we can get to it, because we got a lot of shit going on today.
It sounded a little bit like you were spitting.
We gotta get it together. So I don't have much to catch up on, personally speaking, but I did want to let our listeners know a few things. We are going on vacation. Whoop whoop. Let's ring the bell. Yeah, exactly. Where's my bell at?
Yeah, you tell me.
Missing my bell over here. Hold on.
You're bellless.
We're going on vacation. And so, but we want to stand by our promise. And we're going to continue to have a show every week. So next week, what you will see on the feed will be our Black Panther review. I'm really excited about that. We're going to actually record tonight after our second viewing. Paige is going to be joining us, and also Shirley from Chonilla is going to be joining us. So the four of us are going to get together, discuss Black Panther a bit. I'm very excited about that. So y'all.
And don't worry, you won't be getting white guys' opinion of the movie.
No.
That's not needed or desired.
No, that's true. So that'll be on the feed next week. And then two weeks from now, I'm actually going to put on the feed the very first Interracial John.
Are you really going
to do that? Yeah. For those who have never heard it
the
or listened
so
to it.
Bad.
The audio is terrible. All of those things. But if you're curious, about where we came from, you'll have an opportunity. We're pulling it out from the archives.
You're not even like best of. You're just going to do the first one
I'm going to do the very first one ever. Folks can listen to it. And then we'll be back to our normal regularly scheduled show after that.
Can I look at the show? Do we have show notes from that one?
Yeah, there's show notes on there.
Really? From the very first episode?
Absolutely.
I got to go look at it while you're talking.
Don't look at it while we're talking. But anyways, y'all will see all of that there in the next couple of weeks. Just so you have some content from us and nobody's missing us while we are taking some time off and away. So be on the lookout for those two things.
We don't have number one previous notes. I'm going back. Number one?
Oh, I mean, I have it on the page. I didn't mean have it on the
Of course on the page. I was looking for the actual. If we had
I don't think we have it. I don't know if we saved that there. Maybe. Who knows at this point?
All right. Anywho.
What'd you have? Did you have anything you wanted to share with the peoples?
No, just getting ready for this trip abroad. It's part work and then part pleasure, which is kind of one of the benefits of my job. And my job's been up my butt and kind of bothering me, so I should be a moment of gratitude that it allows me to do things like this, like travel the world and bring my wife around. So even though sometimes I complain, it's still gainfully employed, and I get to do cool things like go on vacation with my wife because of work.
So I do have, there are show notes. There's not much there, but apparently we talked about why we named the show Interracial John.
All right.
We talked about, you talked a little bit about Ferguson and what you've learned about white privilege.
Sounds thrilling.
Yeah. We talked about podcasts we love. We talked about country grammar, the country grammar episode of TBGWT. We talked about Outlander. We talked about the Rebellious Soul book. And we talked about Black Fairy Tales. So I think people will enjoy it.
Black Fairy Tales.
Black Fairy Tales was a good one.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah. So anyways, y'all will get to hear that. I haven't listened to it since we recorded it. So It'll be a surprise to everybody. Anyways, so yeah.
I'm just trying to think about when we did that episode, we like literally sat in front of your computer with an open air mic. The two of us sitting side by side, like handwritten notes for the for the guide and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember. I think I was even like nervous. I really remember, like, I honestly, I feel like I read a script. I think I wrote shit down.
Did you?
Yeah, I swear to God. That's funny. I remember, like, writing, like, it started out by writing, like, more of my thoughts down, and then it turned into, like, writing, like, bullet points, and then it turned into, like, I don't want to have nothing to do with the notes whatsoever. You just tell me what to do. Like, my involvement went downhill from episode one.
Mm.
And probably for the better, to be completely honest. That's a net positive from a subtraction of my involvement in the editorial process. Anywho, you want to get into it? Should we just go?
Let's do it. Let's go.
The news is coming on.
So this week, I we talk a lot about like redlining. We talk about the historic effects of things. But this week, a shocking new investigation by Reveal and the Center for Investigative Reporting has uncovered evidence that African Americans and Latinos are continually, even today, 2018, continuing to be routinely denied conventional mortgage loans at rates far higher than their white counterparts across the country. Reveal based its report on a review of 31 million mortgage records filed with the federal government in 2015 and 2016. And the investigation found the redlining occurring across the country, including in Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Detroit, Philadelphia, St. Louis, and San Antonio. And so they, I'll leave the show notes, but there's a, an interview that they did with the actual investigative reporters. But the report itself is called Kept Out. For people of color, banks are shutting the door to home ownership. 50 years after the Fair Housing Act banned racial discrimination in lending, African Americans and Latinos continue to be routinely denied conventional mortgage rates at rates higher than their white counterparts. This modern day redlining persisted in 61 metro areas when controlling for applicants' income, loan amount, and neighborhood. The year-long analysis relied on techniques used by leading academics, the Federal Reserve, and Department of Justice to identify lending disparities. It found a pattern of troubling denials for people of color across the country, including in the metropolitan areas I mentioned earlier. African Americans faced the most resistance in southern cities, Mobile, Alabama, Greenville, North Carolina, and Gainesville, Florida, Latinos in Iowa City, Iowa. No matter the location, loan applicants told similar stories describing an uphill battle with loan officers who seemed to be fishing for a reason to say no. I'll just share this one story. Rochelle Farrell, a 33-year-old Black woman, was rejected twice by lenders trying to buy a brick row home close to Malcolm X Park in Philadelphia. She says, I had a fair amount of savings and still had so much trouble just left and right. Reveal found that African Americans were 2.7 times as likely to be denied a conventional mortgage.
270% times, 2.7 times.
Yep. The analysis showed Black applicants were turned away at significantly higher rates than whites in 48 cities, Latinos in 25, Asians in 9, and Native Americans in 3. In Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, Reveal found all four groups were significantly more likely to be denied a home loan than whites. Mm-hmm.
You know, and we... there's a few things I want to remind folks, point out, that home ownership is the number one way to generate generational wealth. You can pass, you build equity in a home and then you can pass that on to someone else. You don't get taxed on a house that you pass on to somebody else. The mortgage interest that you pay is a deduction, right? They just changed it. Well, like, oh, the limit used to be $1 million home. Now it's $500,000 home, right? So the interest you pay on that home is deductible. So, and that's the number one, like you talk about entitlement, like, you know, WIC, SNAP, welfare, whatever it is. Primary mortgage interest deduction is like $1 trillion or something. It's the biggest one, in terms of a benefit to people. And it, by and large, benefits white people because, as we know, Black people have been barred and locked out of the home ownership process, which again is the number one way to generate wealth and pass it on generationally. Two, the economic downturn in 2008 was specifically mortgage derivative that included subprime loans, which tend to be more brown and Black people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so like we talk about like, you know, this is happening and it's systemic. And some people like, some of my white friends that aren't quite in the know, they'll be like, well, you know, is there like a cabal of bankers at all these places sitting around saying we're not going to loan to black people? No, but an entire history of like decisions and small little, every individual on a loan process has some discretion, right? Yeah. Like the real estate agent decides which loan officer to recommend you to. The loan person or the broker you talk to decides how much or how little information they're going to get on the preliminary application approval. Like the approval for the first part is not the same at the very end. Right. Like at the very end, there's like a borderline forensic underwriter that's like, let me look at your every fucking thing since your mom's birth kind of deal.
Right.
But on the front end, the like approval process, it could be close to rubber stamp.
Yeah.
You know?
It basically is like, do I trust you or not?
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. And like me, a white dude with a history of owning property and a credit score that's in the excellent range, they don't even like, it's overnight. Like literally the next morning, I've got an approval letter for hundreds of thousands of dollars. I can go shopping for a house. Mm. They throw money at me mm-hmm. and at the lowest possible percent. Like for me, when I as a white man go to shop for a loan, I view it like a commodity. Like I'm buying gasoline and who's got the cheapest gas this fucking week at what corner station? Like literally, I can go to my bank, three other places and look at what the loan rate is and the closing costs and just do the math. If I own this home for 5 years, this is the cheapest person to buy this mortgage from. And I'll go with them because it's literally a commodity. Whereas black people are literally getting screwed over at every turn. So, you know, again, people aren't sitting here going, oh, let's fuck black people, but every little decision. Every little decision. And then you start thinking about like the things that I had to actually do to get a loan. A, you got to have some cash. You got to build up some savings. That ain't fucking necessarily easy for people that are under, they're paid at 70 some odd cents the dollar, right? Mm-hmm. Then two, you got to have a history and usually a pretty long history, many, many years. Again, something that individuals that are forced out of work and have to change jobs for whatever reason is hard to do. And I forget what the last piece is, but just so many things that, like, even I had to get a letter from my employer. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I had to get a letter from my employer. There's just every little step I can see where it would be more of a hardship for black people for a variety of reasons. And that just is as an excuse for an underwriter or a broker to say, no, I'm not going to take your loan. And then they start, that's not even taken into anti-black bias.
Yeah, you know? And even like we can talk about this probably for a whole show, but I did want to point out one thing, which is that gentrification has become low lending laws unintended consequence. This is one of the other findings that came from this, because the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977, which was meant to kind of help low income people buy property in blighted neighborhoods. And so banks were required to kind of like do lending in those areas. So it was designed to correct the damage of redlining, which, you know, allegedly is now illegal. But the law never took into account a day when historically black neighborhoods would be sought out by young white homeowners. So now banks are able to loan, to give loans under the Community Reinvestment Act to white people. And when we couple that with the knowledge that they're not giving loans to black people, period, it's literally like funding and pushing gentrification in black neighborhoods.
Absolutely.
So when we talk about the long tail effect of these discriminatory practices that are baked into our society and systems, this is what we're talking about. Gentrification doesn't happen by accident. But if you are saying, okay, we can loan in this area because this is an area we want to, that the banks are required to loan people money in, And we know they're not loaning to black people.
Yep.
What else is going to happen except for gentrification?
Yeah. We had a friend that worked at a car lending place that ran out of Texas, because Texas has there's limits, right? There's like the law has said, this is the highest interest rate you can charge. You can't be charging people 40% interest. That's a sucker's deal. You just can't do that, right? But the law in Texas allows it to go up to 25% on auto loans, like 24.9%.
This white woman who bought in... In Breeze Point, you know, gentrification abounds there, of course, in Philadelphia. And she talks about how she made lenders compete for her business. You kind of sit there and push them around a bit, quote is her quote. And it's all of these other people that are talking about, these white folks in Breeze Point neighborhood talking about it. It was easy. Once you have a little money, it's really easy to make a lot more.
That's disgusting. So this is the reverse I was talking about. The friend that worked in Texas on the auto loan thing. Mm-hmm. It was primarily the black and brown folks, you know, I forget that they call it subprime, just subprime lenders. And like, let's even talk about credit and credit score and how black people get fucked on that. Like, yeah, we could talk about this all day. But because Texas allowed 25% or 24%, they worked out of Texas. They would loan to black and brown folks. They would put on the loan would be huge, 22, 23, 24% interest. They'd put a low jack type, like, auto start kill thing on the car. And if you missed a payment, instead of like repoing your car, they remote fucking turned it off. They literally remote made it like a dead fucking vehicle. You couldn't turn it on and run it. Like if you missed a payment, not you get a couple of days, not you get this, there's like, bloop, your car's dead. You can't run it. We're going to come pick it up. And just this fathoming that blew my mind that like you're already fucking them by charging them an outrageous interest rate. And then you trust them so little that you're going to put like a low jack fucking like remote like engine kill on it. It was just grotesque.
Absolutely, yeah, grotesque. Absolutely. Well, anyways, we'll be leaving a couple of links for folks all to take a look at in the show notes. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty depressing to look at and to see just how persistent and consistent, you know, black folks and other marginalized communities, but certainly black folks, lamentably the most
at all ends,
are being, you know, cut out and then pushed out.
Yeah.
Systemically, this isn't just happenstance, right? The system is working the way that it was set up to work. So,
yeah, exactly. So, Olympics, you know, we haven't been watching a ton. I've been watching a little bit of curling because I like it. But a couple things just, I would say, I feel like the Olympics are at their low point in terms of like.
Is that what we're supposed to be talking about next?
Yeah, no, because I'm talking about Unilever pulling their ass.
Okay.
But the Olympics, I feel like, are at a low point in a lot of ways, just especially here in the United States, the biggest TV market, mm-hmm. like nationalistic, like. Yay, yay, white people on skis. Just,
yeah.
2018.
It's a hard sell.
It's a hard sell in 2018. It's a hard sell. And the Olympics have been in locations that are like harder to show live here in the United States kind of thing. So I think viewership's been down generally, but, a somewhat unrelated, I think, consequence. Unilever and a bunch of other folks are threatening to pull ads from large platforms, including Google and Facebook. Mm. And they said, we cannot continue to prop up digital supply chain, which at times is a little better than a swamp in terms of its transparency. Unilever marketing boss Keith Weed said, they own the brand Dove, Lipton, Ben & Jerry's, one of the world's top advertisers, has an annual marketing budget of roughly $9.8 billion. And a quarter of that goes to digital. This is not something that can be brushed aside or ignored. He said in his speech, Unilever will no longer advertise on platforms that create division in society or fail to protect young people. And they specifically cited the kind of like Breitbart, like right-wing crazy news sort of stuff. But I think this impacts things like the Olympics and everything else too, because Unilever is a big brand. If they pull all their ads from Google or Facebook, and I posed this to some friends, and I'll pose it to you, Leslie. Again, I think this we're in an age where the perception of moral righteousness is valued in some circles, right?
Yeah.
And so I don't know if Unilever is doing this because they think it's morally correct and they're going to change things, or if this play is politically and perceived and it makes them want to be perceived a certain way. And I guess if it makes change, it makes change either way. But I do think it's interesting. They started with there was a push over the last long time for like 5 to 7 years about not allowing ads alongside content that's undesirable, right? Like, you know, people upload to YouTube rants of swearing and racism, horrible, like, you know, death videos and stuff. And they're like, well, we don't want ads on that content. You got to fucking figure out a way to not have ads on that content. And now they're like, well, you got to have a way to not have ads on entire sections of dubious quasi news sites. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Well, I feel like they have the power. So it makes sense that they would be, you know, kind of pushing the envelope on that, or like trying to hold accountability and where they're able to, you know.
Well, and Facebook's
the leverage they have, right?
Facebook came and they've made a couple different, and they've had a lot of criticism for the fake news stuff. Like literally like Russians were making fake news. Like we just, the fake news shit that gets propagated on Facebook's absurd. So they're trying to make some inroads into that, you know, like the quote unquote filter bubble. And they said that, most of its revenue comes from corporate posts and videos, but it's going to start prioritizing friends and family over those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But like, if your friends and family are racist and sharing fake news, like, how does that change the fake news bubble? I don't get it. But
yeah, I don't get it either. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, they're saying 2018 is the year of the tech lash. Mm. Or the backlash on tech giants.
Whatever that is. Yeah. So I saw this article actually this morning and I just added it because I thought it was really interesting, which is a British court rules that sending defendants to the U.S. prison system is a human rights violation. That was really interesting. President Trump and blah, 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 blah. But as the decision in the United Kingdom's High Court on Monday shows, human rights abuses in the U.S. criminal justice system are putting that cooperation at risk, even with our closest allies. In the ruling, the High Court refused to order the extradition of British-Finnish activist Lori Love to the United States, where he is wanted on hacking charges, on the grounds that sending him to the American jail would be, quote, oppressive due to the poor conditions there.
Yep.
The court accordingly found that the interest of justice required the case to be prosecuted in Britain instead. The decision marks the first time a UK court has used the, quote, forum bar, a 2013 extradition reform that allows British courts to halt extraditions in situations where defendants can be prosecuted instead of the UK, specifically the one a person must have strong ties to the UK. The alleged conduct must have occurred mainly in British soil, and a reasonable argument can be made that the interest of justice would be better served by prosecution there. The UK Parliament adopted the forum bar after an outcry of a string of cases in which the United States asserted prosecutorial jurisdiction over conduct that occurred entirely in the UK. Although several political factors were at play, the extradition reform movement was largely fueled by public concerns that defendants' basic rights would not be respected in U.S. custody. The findings of the High Court in Love's case paint an unembellished but unmistakably grim portrait of the reality of the American carceral state, in which harsh sentences, poor access to medical care, and excessive use of solitary confinement mean that U.S. authorities cannot reliably ensure the survival of vulnerable prisoners. In finding that extradition to the United States would be oppressive to Love, the High Court found that conditions in American jails were not adequate to prevent suicide. That's a quote from their ruling. The court found that Love, who has Asperger's syndrome and suffers from severe depression and other health problems, was likely to be held in solitary confinement as a suicide prevention measure, and that he wouldn't have adequate access to mental health treatment. The court also found that the heightened risk that Love would commit suicide was due in part to the excessive length of sentence Love anticipated in the United States, substantially longer than he would be subject to in a prosecution for similar crimes in the UK. In short, the court found that the U.S. prison system is a mortal threat.
You know, and we have measures here in the United States to prevent extradition to other countries for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Not that reason.
Well, it's usually played as sort of like we are worried it's going to be a kangaroo court, right? Like we don't want to extradite someone to a place like North Korea where we think, well, you know what? We don't think they're going to get an actual fair trial there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Whereas they're saying, yes, it's not a fair trial, but more that the punishment is so severe, that mm-hmm. the system is so broken mm-hmm. that they literally can't ensure their sovereign citizens' basic human rights. Mm-hmm. That's a significant condemnation. I'd love to see that advocate, juror, I forget what they call their lawyers over there, barrister. I'd love to see that barrister's case, because I assume she or he made obviously a convincing case, right? And the data is pretty clear and stark about our carceral system and the conditions with which inmates are held. And even like the solitary confinement, you're right, that's fucked up and that's a terrible thing. General population is just fucking bad. Yeah. Five people in a cell meant for two? That's not humane. Sleeping in conditions where rats are running all over you fucking shit? That's mm-hmm. not humane. Nothing about it, teammate. There was in California, one of the solitary confinement places. I swear to God, you can't even lie down. It's like 4 foot by 4 foot.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Awful, awful, awful.
Awful, awful.
So, shifting to Bitcoin. Mm. We should have Dogecoin, Hiroshi sometime on the show to talk about Bitcoin because it's getting so big and so popular, and they've got a podcast where they talk a lot about it. But in real basic terms, the way Bitcoin works is this sort of like blockchain technology where a computer, so a nation state that wants to make currency can just print more money. That's what the United States does. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, that has an impact on the valuation of the currency based on how much is available in the marketplace. And we can manipulate that by destroying or making currency. Bitcoin, you can't do that. This cryptocurrency blockchain doesn't really work that way, but a computer solves a series of more and more complex kind of equations, and each Bitcoin has a new equation tagged onto the end of it. So the equation to solve Bitcoin 1 gets harder for 2 to 20,000 to 80,000. It gets harder and harder and harder. And this blockchain equation is also the like unique identifier for that Bitcoin, right? It's like, okay, this is a Bitcoin that was made legitimately, and this is Bitcoin number whatever, and there is no other number, this one, and it's worth this value at this date and time. So back in the day, you could make Bitcoin by like running a bunch of powerful computers and sort of serial tandem. You know, maybe if you worked at a university and you had access to some pretty powerful computing, you could make Bitcoin in a period of time that made sense. Like a normal ass person with a computer, might never be able to make a Bitcoin. Might be like trying to solve the equations, and they keep new people make Bitcoins. You'll never catch up, and you never really make it, right? So to make Bitcoins, and people that want to make money now that Bitcoins are worth thousands and thousands of dollars, they build like basically like server farms, right? Like, you know, Google has buildings and buildings and blocks with nothing but servers and computer processing power to run billions of indexes and search and whatnot. And it takes a lot of energy. And they're looking at renewable energy, and Google's concerned about the energy use that their search engine actually consumes out of like these data centers. So Bitcoin now, people are making these similar just massive data centers that do nothing but chunk out these Bitcoins.
Right.
And at 10,000 a piece, like, yeah, I could see that being valuable. So they're going to places where energy is maybe cheaper, easier, and they're happening in different places. But so the story we're talking about here is Bitcoin's energy use in Iceland is going to overtake the entire domestic home usage. So every home in Iceland has an energy consumption, and that consumption is now being overtaken, more than that consumption, by Bitcoin farming. And it's a little bit of concern. So Iceland's facing this exponential rise in Bitcoin mining that's gobbling up more and more power resources. A spokesman for Icelandic energy firm HS Orka has said, this year electricity use at a Bitcoin mining data centers is likely to exceed that of all Iceland's homes, according to John Snorri. He said many potential customers were keen to get in on the act. If all these projects are realized, we won't have enough energy for it, he told BBC. The calculations were first reported by the Associated Press. Iceland has a small population, about 340,000 people, but in recent years it has seen a market increase in the number of new data centers, often built by firms wishing to tout green credentials. Nearly 100% of energy in Iceland comes from renewable resources. Mm. Ah, there's the hitch. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin mining refers to the work done by computers connected to the global Bitcoin network. Computers solve complex mathematical problems, what I already told you about, blah, 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 blah. What we're seeing now is you can almost call it exponential growth, I think, in the energy consumption of data centers. He added that he expects Bitcoin mining operations will use around 840 gigawatts hours of electricity to supply data center computers and cooling systems. Estimates the country's homes, in contrast, use about 700 gigawatts per year. He doesn't see it stopping anytime soon. Running these projects, he gets a lot of calls, potential visitors, so forth and so on. But so it's interesting that they're going there for the touting of the green. The other place where Bitcoin mining and energy is becoming an issue is actually China, because it's not renewable. It's cheap and it's easy. They're burning coal and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So a lot of folks are making data centers in weird rural places in China that are just close to coal stacks.
Right.
So the concern then is that Bitcoin mining is going to create greenhouse gases and so
yeah,
forth and so on.
That's the idea of it, right? I mean, I feel like any energy source is going to be like exploited to the barriers of what's acceptable almost immediately. So yeah, I think that's definitely, and certainly any like financial resource is going to be exploited the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And I
thought it was interesting just in the concept of like, I feel like people were at first, it was like, oh, Bitcoin's this great thing. It's like, you know, electronic
cryptocurrency,
yeah. da-da-da-da-da. Now it's like, oh, also it could ruin the environment.
Well, and it is the one thing that I mentioned, that the U.S. can just print more money. And yeah, like the Chinese government owns a lot of debt in the United States. And if they wanted to do things like print a whole bunch of money and manipulate their currency, they could cripple our economy. It would be good for them, right? Like, because we buy a lot of shit from them. But they really could, by just changing their valuation by printing and destroying money.
Yep.
You can't do that with cryptocurrency, right? The valuation is not able to be fluctuated in that, or manipulated by a nation state in that way.
Right.
But it also, the crypto part means the anonymity, and it has given birth to things like Silk Road and illegal online repositories where people can exchange guns and drugs and things without fear of being caught by the government. And there's also, I don't know enough about storing your cryptocurrency, but I know there are exchanges. Like, we have the New York Stock Exchange, and I have money in various stocks that are held, and you know, Vanguard has a fund that's got some of the shit that's in the Dow or the New York Stock Exchange.
Right.
But I'm not worried about it. Like, you know, ING's not going to get fucking hacked and lose my 401k. But these cryptocurrency networks, Mt. Gox was a big one that got hacked and lost like $30 million worth of people's Bitcoin. Like, that's still an option. Like, you know, there's no FDIC on your Bitcoin.
Right.
Buyer beware.
Buyer beware.
Yeah.
So this next story is not very fun, or but I felt like I had a few things to say about it, which is that the jury in the Corinne Gaines civil trial awards her family $37 million in damages. I'm going to play just a quick short news clip on it.
Profile wrongful death trial. A jury awards millions of dollars to the family of Corinne Gaines, the Baltimore County woman killed by a police officer after a standoff. WJZ is live at Circuit Court in Towson. Rick Ritter has reaction to this closely watched case. Rick?
Denise, it's hard to describe what it's been like in the courtroom over the past 3 weeks with the drama, the emotion, screaming at times. This all-female jury, they sided with the family of Corinne Gaines, and they awarded Cody $32 million. He was injured in this shooting. He watched his own mother get gunned down by police. Such a sad story. And tonight they are calling them a dream team of attorneys, and they say this is a win for anyone who's ever wanted justice. It's a civil trial that's played out like something from a movie. After 3 weeks of heated exchanges and drama, the family of Corinne Gaines has been awarded $37 million.
My daughter will never be back. I don't care how many dollars they owe, $38, $108 million. I couldn't get my daughter back if I begged for
it. It was 2016 when Gaines barricaded herself inside her Randallstown apartment, cradling a shotgun and her five-year-old son. After a six-hour standoff, Officer Royce Ruby Jr. said Gaines pointed that shotgun at his team, so he fired one shot through a wall outside her apartment, hitting Gaines and injuring little Cody. Ruby then went inside, where he claimed Gaines re-racked her shotgun, forcing him to fire three more shots.
This man is a sick, misogynistic, evil person.
The defense argued Officer Ruby was in a kill or get killed type scenario. But what the Gaines family calls their dream team of attorneys caught officers on the front lines of that standoff in lies, with discrepancies between trial testimony and depositions, and said Ruby's decision to fire was callous and heartless.
This guy knowingly assassinated my daughter and injured my grandson to, I believe, beyond repair.
While telling the all-female jury that Cody's scarred for life, as he suffers from PTSD, he's a shell of his former self, they said.
It's hard, and I might have to take that day by day and just try to at least get him back a little back to who he was before this happened.
It only took the jury a few hours to deliberate 3 weeks' worth of testimony and evidence, awarding the family millions. A verdict, they say, makes a statement like never before.
This is a great statement on behalf of many who have been victimized by police officers.
Corinne is smiling today, posthumously. She got her day in court.
And Baltimore County Police say Officer Ruby will not face any discipline because the shooting was ruled justified by the state's attorney previously, of course. And then the county attorney, Mike Field, he released a statement saying in part tonight they are disappointed in this verdict. They are now exploring all options, including an appeal. Live in Baltimore County tonight, I'm Rick Ritter.
So,
fuck Baltimore.
I mean, it's not even just Baltimore, so fuck Baltimore doesn't really work, especially because lots of black people live in Baltimore. But, you know, these jury awardings post, you know, extrajudicial killings have just become, for me, a symbol of slavery, because what it says to me is that black life still has a dollar amount assigned to it and not much more. That there is no inherent value to our lives aside from whatever monetary value is assigned to us after we're gone. And you know, as Corinne's mother said, you know, she won't be brought back by this. And also, this is injustice in a real sense, because this police officer is still free to do this continually to other black folks. And
They said it was justified. So in his mind, he could do this exact same thing again and it wouldn't make it
with no problem. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to, because we had talked about Corinne before, and, you know, I talked about it quite a lot, not just on here, on other shows as well. And I just, it does not settle my soul whatsoever. Yeah. I don't think Corinne is smiling down. You know, her bravery and her, the radical way in which she lived her life, does not have a dollar value for me. And so, you know, while I'm happy, that Cody will have resources to make his life more comfortable moving forward, this won't change the trauma he experienced or the fact that his mother will never be there again.
Being in your mother's arms when she's got nothing, that's outrageous. You don't, at five, that's a trauma that lasts forever. Mm-hmm. That you and I have talked, and maybe even on that first podcast, about would, in terms of getting white people, the moral arc of the universe moves slowly and too slow for your and I opinion, to get white people into action, get them to move into stuff and get busy tearing down systems of supremacy. We talked about would that be an appropriate means to making change for reformation or you know, actual change. And you talked about, like, it really depended on how and what form it went on and how it was presented, but that supremacy knows no bounds anyway when it comes to financial gain or financial retribution. And so the jury's saying, this is a statement. And I remember that said about McDonald's and McDonald's with the coffee. And it was like, this is a statement to big corporations. Man, McDonald's spent all kinds of money fighting tort reform, just their PR, just ruining this person's life. And I feel like we do that with black people that win these awards anyway, right? Like, we victimized Corinne in the first place. And now it's 2 years later and we're awarding, and it's not a statement because nothing's changed.
Nope,
you know?
Nothing.
And I don't know what amount of money and, you know.
And it's not a deterrent. That's the other thing. Because these money, like, these are budget line items for all of these municipalities. So this isn't a deterrent. It doesn't, there's nobody within the system that's like, listen, we can't continue doing this because it's costing us too much money. Nobody's making that case.
I think that this jury hopes that more awards like this would change that. But like you said, it was in New York, I think they said over some like 10-year period, it was billions of dollars. Billions of dollars that they paid out to people that they had killed. And the cops certainly don't care. And it'll only really matter when, I guess, and it'll never matter financially. I don't, you know, we always say when a large city decides, you know what, we're not going to do policing like we have. We're going to do something completely different. That'll be a pretty zeitgeist moment. And I don't think it's going to be because that city paid out too much money in liability. I don't know, but yeah. And I'm with you that, and I hadn't thought of it that way, that an actual dollar amount, it really does, it makes it sound like chattel again.
It does.
You know?
That's how it feels to me. That's how it feels. That's how it hits me when I see it anywhere. So
the Russians, we keep getting more and more information about their meddling and interference. You know, Crystal Johnson won, shook a bunch of people. Me, I should say, shook me up like, holy cow, I can't believe Crystal Johnson won's a fucking Russian bot. But so now special counsel's indictment shows that the minority vote wasn't just suppressed only by restrictive state policies, but by Russian nationals here in the United States. So Russian nationals tried to suppress minority turnout in the 2016 election and spread false claims about voter fraud in an effort to harm Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign and help Donald Trump, according to an indictment announced today by the Justice Department. Indictment says that St. Petersburg-based called Internet Research Agency LLC began in the second half of 2016 to encourage U.S. minority groups not to vote in the 2016 U.S. presidential election or to vote for a third-party U.S. presidential candidate. And this is from the indictment. On or about October 16, 2016, defendants and their co-conspirators used the Instagram account Woke Blacks to post the following message. Particular hype and hatred for Trump is misleading the people and forcing blacks to vote Hillary. We cannot resort to a lesser of two devils. Then we'd surely be better off without voting, and then in caps, at all. On or about November 3rd, defendants and their co-conspirators purchased an advertisement to promote a post on the Instagram account Blacktivist that read in part, choose peace and vote for Jill Stein. Trust me, it's not a wasted vote. And then their third part of the indictment, on or around November 2016, defendants and their co-conspirators used the United Muslims of America social media account to post anti-vote messages such as American Muslims are boycotting the elections today. Most of the American Muslim voters refuse to vote for Hillary Clinton because she wants to continue the war on Muslims in the Middle East and voted yes for invading Iraq. They also purchased debunked claims about voter fraud, including Clinton. Stole Iowa caucus, received thousands of ineligible votes in Florida. And then there's, again, like six other pieces of the indictment. But man, was this widespread.
Yeah, the thing about it is, and this is you know, the investment in white supremacy in this country and society, it was what was manipulated by the Russians. It was completely, they weaponized white supremacy against white people.
Yeah.
In this election tampering. And that's the part I think is very interesting, is that, you know, time and time again, we show over and over again, evidence shows how white supremacy is harming all of us, right? But because racism persists and white people continue to buy into this notion that they are better than, right? They cling on to it despite the fact that it's harming them over and over and over again. And this election is no different.
Yeah, you know, I'm looking, they started all the way back in April of 2016. Let's just, you know. April 2016, they were buying advertisements on all these sort of, you know, black accounts. And when you read them in succession, you're like, this ain't a black person. Like, you can totally tell, but I can see they would have an impact, mm-hmm. right? So the first one was April of April 6th.
Well, what they do is they take a kernel of black radicalism, right?
Yeah.
And then they use that to stoke white fear. So it's like a 1-2 punch. Because there, obviously, there were plenty of people. I mean, we had, what was the hashtag? Girl, I guess I'm with her. Like, that was a real sentiment of like, you know, HRC is not our ideal candidate, right? Was not an ideal candidate. So they take that kernel, right, of reality, and then they distort it to, like, you know.
Yeah.
To the nth degree, so.
Well, and it's interesting. Like, you can see their message changing. Like, it was really like, you know, a great number of black people support us saying Hillary Clinton's not my president. You know, join our Hillary Clinton for prison campaign. Donald wants to defeat terrorism. Hillary wants to sponsor it. Like, that, mm-hmm. that I don't think I heard black people talking about Donald in that way, right?
No.
You know, vote Republican, vote Trump, and support the Second Amendment.
It's like, those are not targets for black folks. Those are targets for Bernie Bros. I'm telling you right now.
Yeah. Well, and it, again, so they pivoted a little bit more and they mm-hmm. got more nuanced.
Yep.
It became more like Hillary, you know, was against, it's just interesting.
Yeah.
Almost like they were trying out which.
Sure they were. They were throwing all the things impact. Out there. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They definitely were. And, yeah. and let's be clear, you know, sexism is what allowed these narratives to even be taken hold of so quickly. People were ready to.
Oh, they were dire. You know, desperate
to hate this woman in a real tangible way. So, you know, all of those things come into play. They really weaponized these systems that oppress people here.
Yeah.
To great success.
And we've talked before, but the just abject hypocrisy.
Well, look, let's be clear. These are the things that the United States does overseas all the time. I want to make that clear as well. These tactics are exactly how we destabilize countries, go in and ensure that the leaders that we want to lead actually win. All of these are part and parcel with exactly how we operate in the world. So there's a part of this that's like, yeah, but y'all do this too. So the government really don't have a lot of legs to stand on.
We reap what we sow, for sure.
Exactly. So
I'm not aghast at the voter manipulation. I'm just like, the vastness of it and it's what a nation state can do.
Yep.
And to think we haven't done that on numerous occasions mm-hmm. in the Middle East and all over the place. Fuck out of here. You know what I mean? Like, we've destabilized governments left and right. You know, we got people that do this in probably more. I'm almost impressed at the sophistication of this. I bet we do it in even more subtle ways.
Yeah. So I saw this and thought this was really funny. Apple employees can't stop walking into the beautiful glass doors at new Apple Park campus. It turns out that when a company loves glass buildings and also creates devices for hours of addictive personal use, sometimes it ends up with injured employees who are too distracted by the products to notice walls. A report by MarketWatch today details how the company has had to call emergency services to assist multiple employees who can't help but accidentally walk into glass walls. None of the injured employees required hospitalizations, but some were treated for minor cuts to the head.
Cuts?
The new Apple campus was slated to open last year, but many employees only began moving into the building this year. After the incidents, employees began using Post-its to mark where the walls are, but the sticky notes were removed because they distracted from the building's design. That's a quote. The irony is delicious that Apple's employees were too glued to their iPhones to notice the harms that they were bringing upon themselves. But legally speaking, it may be a workplace violation. I mean, it's very pretty, but yeah.
Yeah, there's a California law that says workers have to be protected against the hazard of walking through glass by burying or conspicuous durable markings.
Yeah, they don't have those
durable markings a Post-it note does not make.
No. And also, they took the Post-its down, so even if they were ones, it wouldn't even work.
And I'm sure they were stuck to their iPhone, right?
I'm assuming, yeah.
That's kind of ironic that you're on your iPhone and you walked into the Apple glass. There's a person on Twitter that said, first day Apple Park opened, 7 people injured themselves by walking straight into the glass doors. That's just the people who reported it and felt physically hurt. Mm. You know how many other people walked into that shit and just felt stupid and ashamed?
Just dumb.
That's kind of funny. Mm-hmm. You got this music? Because I don't.
Let's see if I do. I don't know. Maybe.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I changed it.
Picked NBC's music?
No, that's the Olympic fanfare theme. It's not an NBC thing. Okay. It's an actual sport theme. They use it, but it's not NBC related.
All right.
It's used worldwide. So we're talking about Olympic shit, obviously. So there's been some controversy with the Jamaican women's bobsled team. This is the first year that the Jamaicans have sent a female bobsled team to the Olympics. And, Jamaican women's bobsled coach Sandra Kirasis quits and owns the team's sled. Jamaica's Olympic debut in women's bobsled is in question following the resignation of coach Sandra Kirasis on Wednesday. According to BBC Sport, Kirasis owns Jamaica's sled, meaning that Jamaican women may not have the equipment needed to compete. Kirasis was asked to switch from driving coach to track performance analyst, which she declined before quitting. She had a statement. She said, "I have never known such disappointment in this sport in my life. The athletes have told me they don't understand why this has happened, as they have no problem with me and we have a good relationship." And in a statement, Jamaican Bobble says, "Sandra Kirasis has elected not to continue her program. We are deeply disappointed in her decision to leave the program. We thank her for her invaluable contribution and contributing to the success of Jamaica's first female bobsled Olympic appearance." Kirasis is a white woman from Germany. She's 43 years old and one of the most decorated bobsledders of all time. She won silver in 2002 and gold in 2006 in the two-woman bobsled. She's also won 13 medals as a world championship. So I'm going to continue the story because there was obviously some follow-ups needed. The story of the Jamaican women's bobsled team was already rife with cinematic drama and imbued with fairy tale like quality, just like their male counterparts 30 years ago. They were hoping to become the first Jamaican competitors in winter sports, but on Wednesday, the narrative began to unravel, mostly over social media, and the team's participation in the Pyeongchang Olympics appeared to be in jeopardy. Over Twitter, the Jamaican Bobsled and Skeleton Federation announced the team's German head coach, Olympic champion Sandra Kirasis, had elected to leave the team. "We are disappointed in her decision," they wrote. And it said, they said Jamaica bobsleigh is led by high performance director Joe Manning and supported by coach Dudley Stokes. Driving coach Sandra Kirasis has elected not to continue. "We are deeply disappointed," blah, blah, blah. It says that her departure will not impact JBSF or its athletes performing in the Olympic Winter Games. The diplomatic messaging was almost immediately undermined by the JBSF president, who said the lady was a hugely destructive force on the team. "Now that she's off the team, synergy is much better. Tension is down and athletes are not able to focus in a much healthier environment," he added. Meanwhile, Kirasis claimed to be blindsided. She continued explaining her side of the story, saying she was forced to quit after refusing to change roles. The shift would have eliminated her access to the athletes, she argued. She insisted that she and the women on the team shared an intimate and friendly bond. Just a few days earlier, one of the bobsledders, Jasmine Ventilator, had said, "Thank you, Sandra, for your passion, friendship, contribution, selflessness, love, and support, and more. We wouldn't be here making history without your efforts, and I'm honored to call you a dear friend. You're forever in my heart." The situation became even more acrimonious when Kirasis insisted she would have to take the team's sled with her upon departure. It was on loan to the team through a connection of the coach, who said she was, quote, legally responsible for its use. According to the BBC, if the team wanted to continue using it, they'd have to pay, she told the outlet. A day later,
Jesus.
Ventilator, a Victorian, posted the following message on Instagram: "Life will test your capacity to adapt before advancing you. So if you're doing all you can and the road still gets rough, you're going the right way. Push." It seemed Ventilator's optimism was well-founded. On Friday, the Jamaican beer company Red Stripe offered, over Twitter, of course, to buy the team a new sled. "No bobsled, no problem. If you need a new ride at Jam Bobsled, put it on Red Stripe's tab, DM us, and we'll be in touch."
No bobsled, no problem. I fucking love them, dude.
So, obviously, everything is fine. And also, JBSF disputes her version
of course,
the facts and insists the team can compete with the sled they originally took to South Korea. In any case, obviously, we'll be watching. Training is starting in South America, and the opening heat start Tuesday. So,
TLDR.
TLDR.
White woman coach helping Jamaican women's bobsled team is acrimonious and horrible and creates division, is asked to alter her role, and in a snippet takes her bobsled and goes home. Is that about right?
Pretty much.
And then completely lies and fabricates, while the Jamaican bobsled team has nothing but graciousness and platitude. Thank you for getting us here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, literally.
Yeah.
That's just like such a microcosm for the world when it comes to black people and white supremacy. Like, white people just shit all over black people, and black people continually raise a hand and, you know, are told reach across the aisle and whatnot.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, you said she was a white woman. I was like, God, it all makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm.
She's a German, you know, and I guarantee you she was like just being a German white woman, right? With a group of black women from Jamaica. That's not going to go over well.
Mm.
Period.
Yeah.
More Olympic stuff. So Yuzuru Hanyu, who we saw skate last night, and my God, dude can really skate. He's good. He's a reigning Olympic gold medal champion. Lots of world champions, and he's beloved in Japan on a level that I've never, like, we've never as a country got behind a figure skater like that ever. They love him like we loved, I don't know, huge athletes.
I don't even, there is no country. Maybe kind of like isn't. Michael Jordan, maybe?
I was thinking Jordan. I wanted to say, like, I couldn't say Muhammad Ali when he was the most recognized person on the planet, because here in America we still kind of fucking hated him.
Yeah.
You know? But so they love Yuzuru Hanyu. And when he wins and does well, they shower the ice with Winnie the Pooh teddy bears. You might have seen that on his short program or long program yesterday, but or 2 days ago. So the Winnie the Pooh themed, where are we here? When Japanese figure skater Yuzuru Hanyu won the short program Olympic Games on Thursday, the weather report inside the arena changed from clear skies to a downpour of Winnie the Pooh bears. As he finished his immaculate routine to a chorus of applause, fans tossed scores of stuffed bears from the iconic A.A. Milne franchise onto the ice. It's an overwhelming number of bears, leading many people at home to ask, why are they throwing these Winnie the Pooh bears?
Mm-hmm.
The reason behind it, little cubs all stuffed with fluff. It's not unusual to see Hanyu keeping company with a plush friend. In fact, it's a long-running tradition that started in 2010 when fans spotted Hanyu carrying around a Winnie the Pooh tissue box. Ever since, they've taken to throwing him bears to show their affection. So that's just the level of, like, celebrity. It was a tissue box 8 years ago. And they're just, and when I say, like, I didn't know there was that many Japanese fans in Pyeongchang. They must have traveled in a lot to see Yuzuru Hanyu. So he won the short program. He also won the long program by doing 6 quadruple jumps. One, I think he didn't touch the ground with his hand, but he didn't quite land it perfectly, but still, like, kept the rotation, so it counted. And he won, I think, by like 20 points.
Yeah, it was really
it was like in a competition where, like, he was 219 or 217 and everyone else was like 197, you know, and they were all bunched within like second and third place were separated by less than a point, and first and second place were separated by 20 points. He's not just good. He's
really
much better than the rest.
Mm-hmm.
The and side note, Tara Lipinski and Johnny Weir, mm-hmm. as they do really great. I love their commentary, and their flamboyance is terrific. But he called Hanzu's skating
liquid silk
yeah. on
and
ice.
And I would agree. I mean, honestly, we watched everybody, and then he was his long program was the last one, and I was like, he doing something that these other people ain't even doing. Like, the way he, just everything, the strength, how high he gets on his jumps, how he comes out of them, it just, all of it was such a higher level than everybody else. It was like, there is no comparison, really.
I forget the top American. He's from Utah, and also of, I think, Asian descent. Maybe his name's, I don't remember his name. But anyway, he did a couple of quads, and the ones he landed were like, it looked a certain way. And then when Hanzu landed a quad, it looked completely different. It just was like, not a struggle quad for everybody else, but he just was popping stuff off. And I'm not even big into figure skating, but you could watch and be like, oh yeah, that guy's winning.
Mm.
He's better than everybody by a mile.
Mm-hmm.
All right, still on the music.
So I only had one this week, which is the hashtag in Wakanda, where black folks on the Twitters were talking about if... in Wakanda, they were kind of dreaming of a world in which, you know, in Wakanda. So in Wakanda, no one has to ask who made the potato salad. In Wakanda, it's dressing, not stuffing. In Wakanda, Lowry seasoned salt is required, and there's no such thing as mayonnaise.
Right on.
In Wakanda, James Baldwin was the Secretary of Education. Mm-hmm. In Wakanda, there's no STEM-focused community programs for black girls because science and girls go together like greens and cornbread. In Wakanda, you aren't pretty for a black girl. You're just pretty.
Oh, I love it.
In Wakanda, everyone stands for the national anthem, but in Wakanda, the national anthem is Nuck If You Buck. Hey! In Wakanda, Coming to America is a documentary. Also in Wakanda, no matter what time you get to the cookout, there's still food left.
Mm-hmm. Loving these.
In Wakanda, the itis is a recognized medical condition. That's a good one. In Wakanda, you don't have to ask the drugstore cashier where the shea butter is. Mm-hmm. That's because in Wakanda, ashiness does not exist. There is jojoba oil in the wind. In Wakanda, Daisus and Mira are the secretaries of housing and urban development, responsible for the freshness of Tim's and chopped cheeses. In Wakanda, Undercover Brother is currently the director of the FBI. In Wakanda, Jim Kelly was the minister of defense. In Wakanda, the candy lady is the village chief. God bless the candy lady. In Wakanda, when anyone says Black Lives Matter, the only response is, duh. Anyways, you can check it out. I'll have a link on the show notes, but there was a lot of really funny ones. In Wakanda, R. Kelly's in jail. In Wakanda, we are not just one nation under God, but one nation under a groove. In Wakanda, the following standard units are standard units of measurement. 50-11, a hole, Dinamug. Mm-hmm. All of those. In Wakanda, the first Aunt Viv was the only Aunt Viv. In Wakanda, Cash Money is in the Wakandan Hall of Fame for taking over for the 99 in the 2000s. And in Wakanda, you can get a master's degree in gospel tambourine. Mm-hmm. Yes. Anyways, a lot of these are really, really hilarious. I just thought that was really funny. That's the only one I wanted to really talk about this week. I didn't see anything else that was
in Wakanda,
amazing.
Good hashtag.
In Wakanda. Check it out. Hashtag in Wakanda.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. This is me, right?
Yeah. You should just send me the link so I can actually play it.
Yeah, I should.
At some point. But
right.
We'll keep this in your wheelhouse as slow as it is materializing.
Yeah. Hey, don't start. I was playing something else before. That's why. So extra. Okay.
So we like these crazy animal stories, mm-hmm. but this one involves a wild, massive boar named Pigzilla.
Pigzilla.
Eating out of a trash can, a dumpster rather. I think it was Hong Kong. You just have to deal with annoying raccoons digging through the trash, but this is a new level of best.
Yo.
A gigantic wild boar was seen digging through a dumpster outside a school in Hong Kong. Her name, also massive, her name's Massive. Piglets roamed on the side. Her three piglets named Massive roamed on the nearby sidewalk. Facebook user Tudong recorded the bear's search for delicious garbage and captioned it Boar King. Wild boars are native to the hills around Hong Kong and can weigh up to 450 pounds. This thing's a beast.
The boar is so huge. Honestly, when I saw the story, I was like, Pigzilla, let me look at this pig real quick. This thing is so big. It looks like the size of like a medium sized cow. Like it's so big. I can't believe the babies are bigger than like Shetland pony dogs. Like they're huge. All of these things are huge.
Yeah. So there's one that lived in Alabama and they called Hogzilla. And of course, an Alabama man shot it, claiming self-defense when it wandered into his yard and was attacking his dog.
This
pig in Alabama weighed 820 pounds. It was a wild boar.
Good God.
Yeah. Like, I know we got things like turkeys and there's a coyote somewhere in the woods, but good Lord, I couldn't imagine having an 800 pound something rumbling through the backyard. that might disturb me a little bit. Where's my see now I'm late. Yes, all cops. And I haven't read this article, but the headline alone, ICE top lawyer in Seattle admits to stealing immigrant identities. Rafael Sanchez admitted using ICE's database to steal immigrants' information and open credit cards in their names. He also named immigrants as dependents in tax returns. Wow. The former chief counsel for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Seattle pleaded guilty to stealing the identities of multiple immigrants using their information to open credit cards and loans in their names while immigrant cases were under review. Sanchez, who oversees ICE immigration removal proceedings for immigrants across four states, used the database, the agency database, to get immigrants' personal information, according to a statement released by the Department of Justice Thursday. According to a plea agreement, Sanchez admitted to taking payments of more than $190,000 from false accounts, betrayed that solemn responsibility, and abused his official position to prey upon aliens. Why'd you use that language? For his own personal gain, Acting Assistant Attorney General John Cronin said in a statement, "We should not let one bad actor detract from the dedicated work." I'm just going to stop right there.
Yeah.
One bad actor. He was the fucking head of your four-state agency in Seattle.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. That's one, like, that's like 12% of the nation. One bad apple.
And it's also a person that's rose in the ranks of your organization. So this is behavior and attitudes that you are fostering and rewarding in your org.
And he used his work computer to do all of this. You gave him the tools. You gave him the tools to forge identity and documents, social security cards, driver licenses. Wow. He had listed three different immigrants as dependents on his tax returns in 2014, 15, and 16. So he's arresting people, and this is just disgusting.
I'm telling you, yes, all cops,
yes,
y'all.
Yes, all fucking cops.
Yes,
and in
all
their
cops,
ICE statement,
y'all.
In their ICE statement, they referred to the immigrants as aliens, which is absolute bullshit because that's the worst fucking language and inappropriate and probably not even true for a lot of these individuals. They're here under legal conditions, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And then to immediately pivot to, you know, we can't let one bad actor take away from the dedicated work that agents and blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
Motherfucker.
Yep. Let's move on.
Wait a second. I turned my music down.
Oh, sorry.
White people, I get bullied in school. I can't wait till I'm a cop so I can bully you. White people. Hey, hey, hey. Hey. White people.
God damn it.
Fucking white people. I'm going to play something here, so I'm going to turn my name. Parents confront Chandler school board, accused of inaction over racial incidents. This is in Arizona, so I'm going to play.
Okay.
Hold those kids accountable. That's why we are here. What's the major issue, Matt? That's right. It's systematic problems.
Who is there that can identify with our black children, with all white teachers? Our children may look a certain way. That doesn't mean they're disrespectful. But because you don't understand our culture, you think they are. My child does not have an attitude at all. I teach her, we teach her how to behave in public, in school. She is a very even-keeled kid. You got the wrong kid, but you got the right mom. I'm here for today.
My daughter's first experience of racism was at Samtown. And that breaks my heart.
They are spreading this hate, and it's coming from home. We know that. So we got to help them, too, because we want all of our children to be whole.
There's been another shooting. Another shooting. And it made me wonder, the young man who did this shooting, was he a bully or was he bullied? Which one was he?
You know that is wrong. I don't care what you have scheduled. You reschedule everything for this. You reschedule everything in your life for this. You know why? Because we all did. This is not hard. You know what's hard? Dr. Evans, you know what's hard? Being a three-year-old kid in Lynn, Massachusetts, having someone throw a brick through a window because his dad's black and his mom's white. That's hard for a kid. Let's do something. My dad moved us out of that damn town. I tell you right now, I'm thinking about moving my family out of Chandler. I don't want to do that. Make some change happen now.
I'm just shocked that it's 2018 and we're not in the South. We're in Arizona.
You are rapidly on your way to being viewed as the most racist school district in America. It's happening right now.
To the community, there are two seats up for election this year. I believe I'm correct in that. Two seats. Thank you. Please consider running. I know I am. Thank you.
Now, So about 100 parents and other community members confronted the Chandler Unified School District Governing Board Wednesday, accusing it of failing to address a pattern of racist incidents at the district. At one point, white board president Annette Oxier left the meeting in tears,
saying she had to go attend a college course.
I can't. The parents' concerns reached a boiling point on MLK Day when a Snapchat video surfaced on social media showing several Santan Junior High School students at a gathering off school grounds chanting racist lyrics to an anti-black song. Students involved in the incident have not been punished or suspended. The school initially released a statement saying the incident occurred off campus and fell outside of its purview. When asked by audience members if the board would consider suspending the students, board member Bob Rice responded, "There was no legal precedence for the district to do so." "You are not acting," said Jeffrey Mobison, whose child attends Santan. "This is not hard. Hold those kids accountable." The public comment section of the meeting was scheduled to be at 7:10. By 7:30, the crowd was visibly frustrated by what they said was stalling and distraction during an opening reflection by board member David Evans. I feel from the school board that they just want us to go away," said Lynn Burnett, whose child also attends Santan. "Come down, talk to the students, talk to the staff, talk to the parents instead of sitting there issuing press statements." The board agenda included a resolution outlining the district's plan to, quote, teach students the value of an inclusive community and give them the tools to be culturally competent in our increasingly diverse society, end quote. The governing board and administration condemns the acts of intolerance that recently surfaced on social media and denounced them as contradictory to the core values of Chandler United School District, the district had written in a pre-written statement. The resolution outlines the district's plan to hire a director of equity and inclusion to implement an equality framework into the district. Combative exchanges resolution passed, but not before several combative exchanges between community members and the board members when discussing its content. Burnett called out Oxier directly when she announced that she had to exclude herself early to attend a college course. "How dare you," Burnett said to XR directly. "I don't care what you have scheduled. Reschedule it. We all did. You're walking out on your freaking job." She excused herself. Oxier excused herself to meeting and left the building in tears. Another speaker was Felicia Gillespie, the mother of Nathaniel Thomas, who was charged as an adult in the Hamilton High School hazing scandal last year involving the football program. Gillespie drew attention to the fact that Santan had no black teachers. "Who's teaching our children black history? When our children experience racism, who do they go to?" Gillespie spoke out against the district last fall, criticizing leaders' slow response in removing administrators and the head of a football coach from their positions. The following week, the district reassigned principal Ken James, athletic director Sean Rustard, and former football coach Still Bells. Now, I want to point out here, I'm stopped because that reassigned. They were not fired. They did not lose their job. They just got moved to another place in the district.
They haven't done their claim that this happened off campus grounds. So they haven't suspended or done anything to these children.
Mm-hmm.
And that you referenced their statement initially. "While the students' actions do not fall under the purview of the school, we condemn on the strongest terms the highly offensive language and actions," Principal Barbara Kowalski said, emailed to parents in South Junior School, which is in the district. "Please continue to reach out to your children and discuss the harm of language that is offensive and inappropriate in our community." And they referenced a song, and I don't know this song, but they had every student in this Snapchat video, multiple of them, chanting in unison, "fuck all," and then that particular epithet. Like, it wasn't just that they, I mean, come on. This is, and they didn't suspend them or do anything?
Nope.
Fuck out of here.
So one of my friends actually is a parent in this particular school district.
Oh, wow.
She has been fighting with them over multiple incidents at her children's schools. I think just this school year, she's been up there at least 4 or 5 times, and she's a fucking lawyer. So, yeah, when I say this is really reaching a boiling point, it definitely is. It's been a lot of problems. Fucking white people. Anyways. Just the pain inflicted on black children by white teachers, white women in particular. Ronnie Dean Byrne talks about this quite often. Excuse me, Dr. Ronnie Dean Byrne talks about this often, about the complicity of white women in our educational system when it comes to how black students are treated. And just, it saddens me, obviously. It's just really sad to me. But, yeah,
and so. This goes on and on and on and on and on. You know, like, what was the racist fraternity that chanted some sort of song with, you know, that epithet and stuff? It's just, I don't want to say something has to be changed, but I think the fact that being called racist is more worrisome than actual racism. Like, that's just got to change. Like, these students that chanted this on a Snapchat, I it'd be great if they were so ashamed of it and it lived on infamy that they couldn't even get fucking like into colleges and shit. But that never happens. That never happens.
Nope.
You know, you said that about the $37 million for Kern Gaines. It's not a deterrent. Nothing in here was a deterrent at all. Students weren't reprimanded. Teachers got reassigned. What deterrent is there?
Mm-hmm.
The woman who is supposed to be held responsible was able to leave the discussion about this in tears.
Yeah, because she's the one that needs to be in tears. She's the one that's aggrieved. She's the one that is a victim and being quote unquote attacked for not doing her goddamn job.
That's insane.
It's the whitest shit ever. That's the part that I was like, wow, she just white woman and all over the place.
Pull the tears out. All right, TV and movies.
So I actually wanted to, you know, we've been watching Black Lightning. I really, you know, my biggest fear going into the show, the stuff I had read about it before it came out, was that it was going to be on this like respectability tip. And so this article is really great, which is in Black Lightning, there's no right way to fix the city. So there'll be some spoiler alerts if you haven't seen it. You probably want to pause for a little bit or fast forward for a few minutes. But the thing I wanted to talk about is how nuanced the show is. I can't even, like, sometimes it's shocking to me. I'm watching it. I'm like, whoa, they're making, they're making commentary about how law enforcement, where their responsibility is. Where is the community responsibility? How do we interact with people that feel that they don't have a voice? And where do we allow them to have a voice? How does this work? It's all about like the complexities of dealing with crime, police brutality, community empowerment. And I just find it so refreshing. I've been so pleasantly surprised and happy about the fact that they're not allowing this to be a one note, one solution narrative on the show. And it's meant, I don't know, to me, it's like almost, it's so groundbreaking. I don't think I've seen anything like it on television.
Well, and that juxtaposition, and I don't know the comic book and whether the character ran a school and was a principal in the comic book, but that juxtaposition really gives the character conflict. And yes, then the character gets to work through that, like, you know, almost like it feels like he tried to change, he stopped being Black Lightning and tried to change things by running the school. And I was like, fuck, it's all the same. And, you know, I have to go back to being Black Lightning. And that duality of being the principal and being Black Lightning is definitely, they explore that really well. And I guess I hadn't seen a show do that either.
Yeah, I just think the fact that they're able to tease out these narratives is really interesting to me. And also, you know, at the core of Black Lightning, the character itself in the show is, you know, he left behind being this, you know, superhero figure in his neighborhood to do the work, you know, with the kids and start early, and then to turn around after 20 years and really nothing's changed. You know, it makes him confront the things that he thought when he put his shield down or whatever.
Yeah.
And ask himself, am I even doing good? Is this the way? What is the way? And I love that there isn't a black and white answer to that, because there is no black and white answer to that.
I also like the sort of, you know, you said there is no way, and I lost my train of thought, but it's done really, really well.
Yeah, I just really enjoy it. I'll include that link. The other thing that I saw that was really interesting was every Grey's couple ranked.
Who's, give me the top three.
All right, here's the top three. I'm assuming number one's got to be Meredith and Derek, of course. Number two is Izzy and Denny Duquette. I'll give them that. That Izzy was a good one.
Yeah, that's good.
Number three is Christina Yang and Burke.
Yeah, that definitely should have been.
I'll do the top 10. Miranda and Ben are number four. Jackson and April. Nope. J-April is trash. Like, they should be the very last couple. They're horrible.
Bird bones.
Richard Weber and Ellis Gray. I'm not really going to go for that one. One, Richard was married to his wife when they were having an affair.
Right. How's that a couple?
Two, they had like a secret baby that one of them didn't know about. None of this is good.
That's kind of a, no.
Mick Steamy, Mark Sloan and Lexi Gray. I would have put them way higher. I really love them as a couple. I thought they were really well paired. Then they have two after Richard and Ellis. They have Richard and Adele. This is trash. Izzy and Alex is nine. Nope. Teddy and Henry.
Are those all heterosexual?
Yes.
Yeah, where's...
Richard and Catherine are 11. How does old black dude ended up in three of the top 11? I'm going to keep going till we get to till we get to a couple that's not heterosexual. Stephanie and Kyle? Mm-mm. Alex and Joe? Definitely not. Mark and Addison? Mm-mm. Derek and Addison? Christina Yang and surgery?
Come on, that's ahead of... Just stop.
That's ahead of the first non-heterosexual couple, which is Callie and Arizona.
Just come on. And what? Which was the... who lost her leg? Callie?
No, Arizona did.
Arizona did. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Arizona did.
And they were together for a long, long time on the show. Many years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And was there even a... And no one else had a... I'm trying to think of other prominent non-heterosexual relationships they've had.
They had Callie and Penny. They had...
Did George have a relationship with somebody? No.
No. Well, George had Olivia, but... She gave him an STD, so I don't think that was a good one.
That's not in the top 10. Mm-mm. All right. Well, I wouldn't agree with all of those, but...
I wouldn't agree with most of those.
I get it.
Somebody dumb wrote this, just saying. So movies, actually, like I said, the only movie I've seen recently is Black Panther. We're going to see it again today. But y'all will get a full review of that from us next week, including our special guest, Paige, and also Shirley from the Chonilla podcast. I'm excited to talk about that with them. But I did something this past week, which is launched the A Wrinkle in Time Challenge with seven of my dope-ass girlfriends. And I just want to read a little bit of the piece that Sharonda J. Brown wrote in launching the challenge, which is Black girls are a storm. Roaring tempests from the moment they come into being, thunderous and bold, full of dancing, whirling winds, and remarkable energy. Sometimes they're too much for the world, and it will ask them to shrink, to quiet their spirits, and to put out their light. But Black girls shine anyway. They amaze me. So we launched this initiative.
By the way, it's an amazing piece.
Of course. The whole piece is amazing. Y'all should for sure read it and share it everywhere because we are specifically raising money to give the gift of the wrinkle in time to as many Black children as we can. And we will center Black girls and other non-boys in this work. Please join us in the A Wrinkle in Time Challenge as we raise funds to purchase full theaters in 8 U.S. cities so that we can fill the seats with Black girls and non-boys to experience this important film together. I'll have the link on there, but you can go to bit.ly/AWIT challenge to just go and donate. Every dollar counts. We're looking to raise $25,000 to fund all of these showings. And we're really excited about it because this will be in 8 different cities all across the country. And hopefully people will join us in making this this effort a reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
The other thing I wanted to mention is kind of news, kind of movie stuff, but Tessa Thompson is set to star as Doris Payne, our girl, in a jewelry heist movie. Tessa Thompson has signed on to portray Doris Payne, a woman who gained notoriety for her luxury jewelry heist around from stores around the world. The film is considered a high concept action drama in the vein of Catch Me If You Can and The Thomas Crown Affair. Co-Black Films' Candace Wilson will oversee the project. In her 6-decade-long career, Payne, who is now 87, would enter jewelry stores posing as a well-to-do woman looking for a diamond ring and asked to see an assortment of items. Using her charm, she would eventually cause the clerk to forget how many pieces were outside the case and leave with one or two pieces. So I'm really excited about it. Tessa actually posted, she's like, this has been in the works for so long. I'm so excited to finally have it being announced. And she's perfect. She actually looks quite a bit like Doris. So I think this will be really dope.
That is amazing.
Go ahead, Doris.
I'm just putting up, wait a minute.
What's the matter?
I was trying to do a tweet up. That's okay.
So the last thing that we do want to talk about, we just finished, which was Altered Carbon on Netflix, which we really enjoyed. Highly recommend. I'm not going to do any spoilers because I have a feeling not a lot of people have watched this. But the thing I wanted to talk with you about was I low-key want to watch it a second time now that I know the story and I'm not like trying to follow everything because as we were watching, I was like feeling all of these references and homage-y type of vibes from Blade Runner to Running Man to Aliens to I felt like there was many.
We played the 5x5. They did a joke about 5x5, which is a direct Aliens reference.
Yeah, so I feel like I want to go back and watch it a second time to pick up on those things because I was so engrossed in the story that I didn't get to. I highly recommend.
The story was engrossing.
And
you had to kind of pay
attention.
And it
was complex. So, you know, you definitely needed to like pay attention.
I was messing around and wasn't watching the first like 18 minutes. I'm like, nope, I got to rewind and start all over again. I'm totally confused.
Mm.
But it was dope. I liked it a lot. And I liked I thought the ending was good. And I thought it made sense.
Yep.
And I didn't think they had too many characters that were like superfluous and out of the, you know, not good kind of thing. Didn't have enough black people. Again, like a future 300 years in the making and there's no black people, but. Well, I guess maybe when, cause, and this isn't spoiling anything. This is like out of the first episode, but with that whole like sleeve and body thing, you can, I guess white people wouldn't choose black bodies or something. I don't know. But yeah, it was good. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, it was very good. So highly recommend.
I would have liked more of the actor that, played the Japanese character in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't need to spoil more for people. So
that's not spoiling. It's like the first 10 minutes of episode.
It's a little spoilery, but
it ain't. It's the first 10 minutes of episode one.
Mm-hmm. It's still a little spoilery, but whatever.
Please.
All right. Well, I think that's the end of the show.
What?
We got through it. We did it.
Okay.
Huzzah. Put
the game. Wait a minute. Wrong button.
Good night, everybody.
High five.